listening to The Nature Between Us. My name is Tessa and I'm your host. This podcast is produced on the land of the Bidjigal and Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I pay my respects to elders past, present and future. Today's episode is the first for season two, so I'm jazzed. But what's even better is that I'm speaking with one of Australia's most accomplished climate campaigners, Anna Rose. Anna is an author and environmental advocate who has worked for over two decades to help Australia make progress on climate change. She co-founded AYCC, the Australian Youth Climate Coalition, as well as the Giving Circle Groundswell. She's on the board for Farmers for Climate Action, a governor of WWF Australia, and co-star of the ABC documentary I Can Change Your Mind on Climate Change. But beyond her impressive CV, Anna is also just such a positive energy in the climate movement. And at a time when natural disasters are on our doorsteps and the climate conversation supercharged, I wanted to hear from someone who's experienced political change firsthand and knows exactly how to turn the dial for good. We chat about her earliest climate wins, such as taking down BHP in high school, how to approach climate conversations, and of course, the upcoming federal election. Enjoy. Anna, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, so welcome. Good to be here. I'm calling in from Bundjalung Country, so Lennox Head in northern New South Wales.
Oh, you're up north. Gosh, I didn't realise you were that far up north. How's everything going with the floods?
It's been really devastating for the community and it's changed the region forever, I think. There'll be some families, many families, that it's going to take months or years to rebuild. There'll be some people that never recover from this if the level of government support doesn't massively increase. And I guess for me as a climate campaigner, and many of us in the region are very environmental, it's really brought home that climate change is happening now. It's not something that is in the future. We are literally living the impacts of it, because for every degree of warming, the atmosphere holds 7% more water.
Yeah, it's definitely on our doorstep, isn't it? Makes it feel very much more of a real thing than something that they talk about in the future. Mm. I want to start our conversation kind of back at the beginning of your journey into climate activism and climate advocacy, because you've been fighting for climate action for two decades now, which is a reasonably long time when you think about kind of how prominent climate change is in our media and in our conversations. But two decades ago, it really wasn't. And I'm just curious to hear what it was for you that crystallized in terms of climate action needing to be an urgent thing two decades ago.
Well, I got involved in environmental action when I was 14. And my mum's family are all farmers. So I grew up in Newcastle, but we spent a lot of time with my cousins and uncles and aunts and grandparents on their farms in the Hunter Valley and in northwest New South Wales and the Liverpool Plains. And so growing up, I really had a connection to nature, not just in the sense of going away and spending time in the bush, and we did a lot of bushwalking and camping, but also seeing that the environment was integral to our food production systems and, you know, spending time on farms. And so when I learned about climate change, and back then it was called the greenhouse effect, or the enhanced greenhouse effect, in science class when I was 14, it was at the same time as the drought was really devastating New South Wales, and particularly the areas where I had a lot of family living. And so I remember learning about how more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere trapped heat, and that this was affecting our water cycle and leading to more intense droughts, and then when it does rain, to extreme weather events like floods. And it just seemed to me that this was going to be something that would affect our generation for, you know, if we didn't have policies to turn this around, that it would be affecting our generation in our lifetimes. And so that's what got me engaged in the issue. And I set up a little environment group at my school after that, because I felt really hopeless for a long time. I guess after that science class, maybe 9 or 10 months, just sat with the knowledge, and it was not just climate change, but also learning about broader environmental challenges, biodiversity loss, pollution, ocean, degradation. So was all of these issues that I was thinking about as a young person, realizing that they were going to affect us in our lifetimes. And then someone from a local environment group came and gave a speech at my school and said, just start where you are. And so I was at school, and so I set up a little environment group, and I learnt through that small groups of people really can make a difference, because we started by transforming our school to be more sustainable. We set up recycling, which our school didn't have. We set up composting. We planted native trees on our school grounds. And then we ended up joining a community campaign that was being run by the Worimi traditional owners, by a local residents group and this local environment group. So our little high school group joined, and it was a 4-year campaign for me. It had been going on before for many years, but by the time I was 18, we had won that campaign. The place that we were trying to protect from a mine that BHP wanted to build, the state government had said no to BHP and instead handed it back to the traditional owners, to the Worimi people, to manage as a conservation area. And so I think for me, as a young person, seeing that actually ordinary people, local residents, traditional owners could actually go up against one of the biggest mining companies in the world and win, that made me realize that we are all so powerful, and that in Australia we live in a place where we can actually intervene in democratic processes and be part of that democracy and win.
That's amazing. I love hearing that story that you went up against BHP when you were in high school. That's phenomenal.
It was a really empowering experience for everyone involved in that campaign, and most of us were new to social change and to activism. And then after I went to uni, my friends and I wanted to get our university to do more on climate change. And so we ran a campaign to ask them to switch the university's power to 100% renewables and to invest more in renewables in terms of the research and development that was happening inside the science and technology faculties, and also for the university to divest from fossil fuels with its corpus. And we didn't win all the way, but we did manage to get some pretty big concessions out of the university administration at the time and take them a lot further on their sustainability and climate policies than they would have wanted to if we weren't there running that campaign. And that ended up being replicated at other university campuses across Australia. So again, I saw early on that people power really can make a difference. And it's not enough to just do things individually at home, change your light bulbs on climate. We don't have time for that to be an approach that is enough. And so people coming together collectively to accelerate renewable energy, to close down fossil fuel projects and the expansion of fossil fuels in Australia, and move our big institutions like universities or companies and ultimately government, we can do that collectively. We actually have the power in Australia to be able to make that happen.
Mm. Well, you've just mentioned the government, so why don't we move on to talking about the upcoming federal election, because obviously it's a hugely important moment for the climate movement here in Australia. What responsibilities and obligations do the federal government actually have in relation to climate action?
Well, ultimately, we need a federal government that is taking a leadership role on climate. At the moment, the current government, which is comprised of the Liberal and National parties, has a commitment to reduce emissions 26 to 28% by 2030 and then get to net zero by 2050. But this isn't legislated, and so there's no real legal mechanism to hold them to that. And unfortunately, we have seen a lot of policies from this current government that have accelerated the gas industry, which is a huge polluter in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, and that has tried to prop up coal, and resisted calls from, you know, most environment groups and climate groups are calling for at least 50% by 2030 reductions in carbon pollution, if not much more. I mean, most of our leading scientists say we really need to be getting to at least 75%. So if you look at the gap between what the scientists are saying we need to do to turn around the climate crisis and then what the current government is doing, there is a big gap between, I call it reality and then political reality. So, we haven't seen a good track record from this current government. Obviously, there are other parties and candidates that are contesting this election. And I think climate is not going to be the biggest issue this election, but it is an important issue. And it's one in this pre-election period where everyone has the chance to make their voice heard and speak to all the parties, all the local candidates that are running in your electorate, and ask them what their plan is as an individual, as well as what their party is bringing to the table.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that having political change is the be-all and end-all for climate action? Like, do we need political change, or could we solve the climate crisis without?
We need governments to act to make progress on climate. We don't have enough time to leave it up to the market or leave it up to individuals. We need government regulation. We need government funding. We need actually the policy framework to reduce emissions to safe levels. So the reason that I say this is scientists have been saying for a long time that climate change is it's a problem that's different to other problems because of the time frame. So if you think about past social movements like women getting the vote, there was an urgency in the sense that every election where women didn't vote was one where we weren't having a proper democracy, but there was no deadline where if women didn't get the vote by a certain date, they would never get the vote, if that makes sense. Whereas on climate, there are these things called tipping points in our atmosphere. And I don't want to get too complicated and scientific, but essentially they are really important to understand to get your heads around climate. So there are four things in terms of the science of climate. One, greenhouse gases trap heat in the atmosphere. And that is a basic principle of physics that was figured out back in the 1800s. Secondly, we've been pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere at large scales since the Industrial Revolution. And that's been getting bigger every year. And third, that we know from measurements from NASA and the Bureau of Meteorology and all of the government and intergovernmental weather agencies that we can see temperatures rising since we've started pumping large volumes of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. And then the fourth thing that's important to get your head around that links to the time frame on climate is that we have these tipping points in our Earth system, which are basically, scientists call them the points of no return. After these tipping points are triggered or after they're passed, it's not possible to keep global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees. It unleashes a trajectory where you can't bring it back. And to make it more concrete, maybe I'll share the example of the permafrost, which is in the northern, like Siberia and Russia, Canada. So there's these gases, methane and other gases that are trapped in this frozen permafrost, and they've been trapped there for a very, very, very long time. As the globe heats up, this permafrost, which is kind of frozen vegetation, starts to melt, and then it releases those gases that we thought were safely trapped away forever back into the atmosphere, and therefore turbocharging the amount of greenhouse gases and the amount of warming. And then another example is the Arctic ice, which at the moment, if it's white, it reflects heat into the atmosphere. And then when it's dark, it will actually absorb that heat that comes in from the sun and put it into the oceans, which accelerates warming oceans. So again, you turbocharge the warming cycle. And that is why on climate, we have this limited time frame to turn things around, and why scientists call the decade that we're in now the critical decade to act. And they say we've got 7, 8, maybe 9 years left to really turn things around on climate, which is why, to bring it back to your question, we need governments, federal government, state government, local government, to act. I think one of the most challenging things as an environmentalist is you see that people want to do the right thing. They want to recycle, to plant trees, and to do things in their personal lives. And that's really powerful. And we do obviously need behavior change for people to do their bit. But if we left it at that, we would not get the change on the scale that we need to turn things around. Because if you look at the biggest contributor to Australia's emissions, which is what drives climate change, it is our energy sector. So we need governments to put in place policies and frameworks that enable renewable energy to quickly accelerate. And it is the cheapest form of energy. You know, if I was an energy developer and I was choosing to build a new coal-fired power station or a large-scale renewable piece of infrastructure like solar or wind, it is much, much cheaper to build new solar and wind than it is to do coal. And so the market's going there anyway. But at the moment, the Australian government subsidises fossil fuels to the tune of about $11 billion a year. So we did not have an equal playing field. And we don't have the policies in place that most of the rest of the world does to accelerate the renewable transition. And it's the same with all sectors, transport, agriculture, built environment. There are so many solutions that we have. It's not like we don't have the answers. It's about not having the policy frameworks in place at all levels of government, federal, state, and local, to actually get those solutions out at large scale.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I feel like I've been having these conversations for a few years now, and everyone keeps reiterating, like, we have the solutions. We know what, you know, there are countries that are doing it already, like Denmark and Sweden, like, you know, they're leading the charge in terms of their shifting of the energy sector and other sectors that are very dependent on fossil fuels. And even letting it trickle down to beyond the fossil fuels, like we have the answers, but yeah, it's like the government is the gatekeeper at this point in Australia. So with all of that in mind, what would you recommend to people who want to vote for the climate in this upcoming election?
The main thing is to be informed about in your electorate, and it's different in every electorate. So it's impossible to say, you know, that there's one most effective way of voting nationally, because there's different candidates, there's different parties. Some seats are marginal, so it's going to be actually more important that you engage in the democratic process, because your candidates will be really listening to what voters have to say there. But I would say research the policies of the candidates that are running in your electorate. Even if you already think you know who you're going to vote for, call up the offices or send an email and say, I haven't decided who I'm going to vote for because I want to know more about your climate policies. And do that to all parties, because that sends a message that voters care about climate. We need this message to be going to every single political party and every single candidate to demonstrate that it is going to be a major election issue. Ultimately, politicians don't really care, unfortunately, about how many people care about an issue. They only care about how many people are willing to switch their vote over an issue. So if you can talk to the people in your network who haven't made up their mind how to vote and say, you know, is climate something that matters to you? Let me share some reasons why it matters to me. Let's get in touch with our candidates and ask them what their policies are so we can make an informed decision. And there are tools like Vote Compass on the ABC where you can put in the things that matter to you, and then it shows you the policies of all the different parties and which ones aligns best with you. Spend an hour, just everyone spend an hour researching and asking your candidates, because they'll never be listening to you more than they're listening to you in the 30 days before an election.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I like the idea of sending them an email and asking them, because it's kind of like a bit of a flag, like, hey, I'm, you know, I normally vote for this person, but I'm open to being swayed. If you want to sway me with your policies, what are they?
This season, the podcast has had some extra love in the form of two epic prize packs from the wonderful and sustainable people at Spooked Kook Surfboards, Camp Cove Swim, and For Purpose Recycling, which you could win. To go in the running to win a brand new soft top surfboard and an FPR belt, or a Camp Cove Swim gift voucher and an FPR belt, all you have to do is leave The Nature Between Us a rating and review on iTunes/Apple Podcasts, subscribe to the pod, and follow all four Insta accounts. The winner will be picked at random by the end of season two. You'll hear me speaking a bit more about each brand throughout the season, but for now, I just want to say thank you for their support and commitment to the environment.
Outside of voting, what are some of the other ways that individuals can take climate action?
There are so many great things that everyone can do, and there's no one thing, because everyone has different skills and networks and lives in different places. And so there's no silver bullet. It's about finding what is the best fit for your skills and your time capacity to volunteer or donate. So I guess to make it more concrete, because that's a very broad answer, I am a really big fan of, there's a lot of new groups that have popped up in the last few years to mobilize a specific sector or a specific group of people on climate that can fit with someone's networks. And so I'm talking about groups like Farmers for Climate Action. You know, if you're listening and you're a farmer, you should join Australian Youth Climate Coalition. If you're a young person, SEED, Indigenous Youth Climate Network for young First Nations people, Parents for Climate. Maybe you're listening and you have young kids, and I know that means you can't go to a lot of meetings because you're time poor, which is me. So get involved in the Australian Parents for Climate Action Facebook group, which is a really strong community with lots of opportunities to take action that are kid friendly. And then there's groups like Doctors for the Environment. Or I just got an email this morning about a new group that's setting up called Teachers for Climate. There's Outdoors People for Climate, which if you're into bushwalking and hiking and camping could be a really good fit for you. So I think, you know, you've got your big environment groups and they're doing fantastic work. But if you want an opportunity to volunteer and to really throw your talents towards something that fits with where you're already at in your life, I think looking at those groups is a really exciting opportunity to volunteer. And then there'll be some people who are really, really time poor and can't volunteer with anyone but want to donate part of their salary or part of their savings into climate. And I would suggest getting involved in Groundswell, which is another project that I helped set up 2 years ago now when the bushfires, the Black Summer bushfires happened. And that's also a really easy opportunity to be part of funding climate advocacy that's highly effective.
Yeah, awesome. I'm glad you brought up Groundswell because I wanted to ask you about that. You've kind of already just briefly, you know, mentioned that it's about funding, like crowdfunding, or not crowdfunding. What would you call it?
It's a giving circle. So collective giving.
Yeah. Collective giving. And then that gets distributed amongst a number of grant recipients. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's a really fun process and our members love it. So essentially people contribute $20 a week or $1,000 a year. And some people join as a family unit. So that $20 might be split between parents and kids or even grandparents, parents and kids. We have some beautiful multi-generational memberships. And that goes into a shared pool. And we have roughly four times a year, we have grant rounds. And we get about 30 applications from climate advocacy groups. So we fund climate advocacy. And that means organizations or projects that are building the climate movement, shifting the story on climate, changing the politics, or shifting the money, you know, drying up the pipeline of funding to fossil fuels, essentially. And so if the applications meet that criteria, it's usually about 30 applications that we get each grant round, and they're fantastic, and I wish we could fund them all. A committee of our members, and we literally pull them out of a hat. You can put your hand up to be on the shortlisting committee. Arielle, who runs Groundswell, will pull them out of her hat. And we have a team of shortlisting volunteers who go through those 30 applications and they shortlist it down to 8. And then that goes out to every single member. And every single member gets a vote, or every membership gets a vote. And then it's always really close, actually, because all the projects are so good. But those organisations receive a grant of $40,000. Those four finalists out of the eight, sorry, the four winners out of the eight finalists receive a grant of $40,000. So we've now given $960,000 away through Groundswell, so almost a million. And we don't have a corpus, like a pot of money that we keep. Basically, as soon as we raise the money, it goes to a grant round and then we spend it because climate change is urgent and we need to be getting money out the door to fund effective advocacy now.
I love that. It's so satisfying to hear that, like, it your little $20 note a week or whatever it is that you can afford just goes towards this actual big chunk of money that is like instantly redeemable by an organization that needs it. So cool. I love it. I'll be putting the links to Groundswell in the show notes so everyone else can join along if they wish. I wanted to go back to talking about campaigning because obviously that is your world and what you've done for the last two decades. I'm curious what it is that you've learned about the way people respond to climate change and what you've found is the best way to kind of have that conversation. I know that some people are still finding it difficult to have these kind of conversations with their family members or their colleagues. And I know that it's something that is in the media, it's in our world quite, you know, quite readily now, but I still think that it is difficult to connect with people on a real level that isn't politicized or fear-mongering. And I'm curious what you found, like how you go about connecting with people on the issue of climate change.
I approach conversations about climate with people who, you know, aren't yet engaged in the issue or maybe opposed to climate solutions. from a perspective of kindness and respect and listening, just like I do any issue that has been politicized, and this never should have been politicized because it's really just about protecting our water and air and soil and our kids' futures. But I have a motto: be kind first, be right later. And I think,
love that.
Yeah, it's about finding common ground. And also, you don't necessarily need to start by talking about climate change or the science, because the cool thing about where we're at now in history is that by implementing the solutions to climate change and by accelerating renewable energy, we will create more jobs, more economic opportunities, particularly for the regions that have been overlooked. And in many cases, coal has been the only option, or gas has been the only option, in terms of huge new employment opportunities coming into a region. Obviously, there's always going to be other opportunities that have been there a long time, but those big boom and bust cycles, you've seen a lot of fossil fuel infrastructure contribute to that. So often I will talk about the opportunities that Australia has to be a renewable energy superpower, to bring manufacturing back to Australia by creating renewable energy hydrogen, which can create really cheap and abundant energy, and the opportunities we have to export renewables to the rest of the world, the opportunities we have to get critical minerals, which Australia has lots of opportunities in that space. So, you know, you can start the conversation from shared values around how do we create jobs for our kids. Maybe, you know, maybe I'll be talking to a family who's got a parent who works in coal mining, but their kids, that parent knows that there's not going to be that opportunity for their child. And so what are the opportunities, given that the world is moving towards renewables and Australia's a laggard, but how do we make sure that we don't lose those opportunities and that we do realize that potential that we have? So yeah, I would say, listen, be kind first, be right later, make friends with people, you know, don't approach things as an argument. It never works. And just try and understand where they're at. And also don't assume ever that you're going to change someone's mind on an issue, particularly climate, in one conversation. You know, I've done a lot of research into high profile business leaders and politicians that have gone from rejecting climate science and rejecting climate solutions into becoming advocates for climate action. And often it's a series of events or conversations with their family, with their staff, with voters that they're interacting with over a number of years that will make the difference. And I might also recommend a book by a friend of mine, Rebecca Huntley, who wrote a book called How to Talk About Climate Change in a Way That Makes a Difference. That's a really good one.
Oh, yeah. I interviewed her. Perfect. Yeah, I interviewed her for the first season. She's amazing. And I love that book. Yeah. Yes. If anyone hasn't read that, then definitely put it on the top of your list. Do you think the recent floods and the fires has, I mean, you've lived it firsthand up in Bundjalung country, like, do you feel like there's been a shift in opinions or views?
It's hard to know. I know the fires made a big impact in terms of a certain percentage of the population that was concerned about climate but not acting. It really tipped them into acting, and that's why we set up Groundswell, because we had so many people contacting, you know, myself as a climate campaigner and saying, who do I fund? I want to get involved in climate. I don't know where to start. In terms of people who aren't engaged in the issue, it probably did increase the level of education about climate because it was in the media more. So the media has a big role to play in prioritizing issues, and having knocked on many, many doors to talk to people about climate, often the thing that's on the front page of the paper is when you have a conversation and say, what issues matter to you, will be the thing that they say just because it's on the front page of the paper. So I think the fact that the floods and before that the fires were getting more media attention, yes, it's raising awareness. There's still not enough coverage of the links between extreme weather events and the climate crisis. And that's why it's great that people are listening to podcasts and, you know, reading things on their own initiative, not just relying on what's on the front page of the paper. And I think that there already are a lot of people, you know, in the region where I live up here, where they already totally got climate change,
and yeah,
it's probably made it more urgent, and there's a lot of emotion now in our community around why isn't the government acting, not just in terms of climate policy but also supporting communities who are on the front line of these climate impacts.
Yeah. I recently saw the latest documentary by Damon Gamow. I don't know if you've seen it.
Yeah,
the Regeneration.
Yeah.
The Regenerate Australia. And it just, I thought of it when you were saying enter the conversation with whoever it is that you're speaking first with kindness and then not wanting to be right. And it made me think of it because that film for me was like, it didn't lead with any sort of doom and gloom. You know, it was so much about these are the solutions. Like it almost like got me excited for what could be or what will be hopefully eventually. It just made me think of that as another solution or another tool with having these conversations. It's like it is really exciting to see it's like a hypothetical about what it could be if we choose to make that our reality.
I think it's a really starting with solutions and talking about solutions is definitely much better than talking about doom and gloom with everyone. No one really wants another problem because we've got enough in our daily lives, right?
Yes.
But how do we step back from that and say, how can we dedicate a few hours a week or, you know, a certain percentage of our income into getting involved in climate advocacy, funding climate advocacy, making our voices heard and being part of the solution?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to put you on the spot for the last question. I heard you say before that you love motivational quotes. So I thought a nice place to end our conversation would be to hear one of your favorite quotes. And you can take a moment to think about it.
I don't need a moment.
You don't need a moment.
So many.
Well, I think there's more than one, but yeah.
I think I have the one that I actually have on my wall right next to my desk is, those who say it can't be done should get out of the way of those already doing it. And I love that because being involved in the climate space, I do feel hopeful that we can turn things around. And that is because I see every single day people and organizations who are making incredible progress on climate in the political sphere, in terms of finance, moving money away from fossil fuels and into renewables, in terms of building public awareness and education and that groundswell of support for climate action. In terms of practical things, you know, I get notifications when hospitals go 100% renewables or vet clinics, or there's just so many people doing things in their own sphere of influence. And so when you see that every day, you realize how many people and how big this social movement actually is, not just in Australia, but globally. And honestly, the number of people who are opposing this are small. It's just that they happen to be in positions of power, often, you know, in government or in business, but that is changing. So yeah, those who say it can't be done,
get out of the way
of those already doing it.
That was Anna Rose. You can keep up to date with her on Instagram at Climate Action Anna, and get involved with Groundswell Giving at Groundswell Giving. Thanks for tuning in. If you liked this episode, shoot the pod some love on iTunes or send me a message at the Nature Between Us podcast on Instagram. Ciao for now.